I am Joanne Holt. My area of specialization is physical education first and history of American sports second. I know you've all had history over here earlier this morning, so you're sort of in the mood for it. What I'm going to be dealing with today is kids should be kids in play, game, sport, athletics, exercise, all of which leads to fitness. My reference for today is a book in which I depend heavily upon it, Every Kid Can Win. I would urge your husbands to read it almost more than you. I have found through the times here that those that probably really need to be exposed to this the most are your husbands. So you're going to have to deal with them, as you do anyway, on the raising of your children. It is the males in our society who have been programmed for the kinds of competitive athletics that we have in our society, as opposed to the female. As the female moves into it, she brings in some of the positives of the female play life, but primarily is imitating and role modeling after the males in our society. And that's one of the things that has gotten me more concerned than I was before, because I am one of the women who has campaigned, lobbied, and worked towards Title IX, which has to do with sport as well as general education, and who attempted to deal with a kind of sport model which was not as competitive. So as we talk today, if you can sort of take some mental notes of the most potent points that you would like to share. It also is being recorded, and therefore they may be interested in at least listening to a part of it. You'll notice that I am, for those who are not present, using gold note sheets. Now, why would I use gold note sheets today? The Olympics. It is probably the pinnacle of the sport experience and also the pinnacle of the competitive spirit and what I call the winning syndrome. And so I thought it might be apropos to do my note-taking on the gold, symbolic that I believe in it. I believe in the Olympics. I believe in highly competitive athletics. But in the process, what we have lost is the bottom part of the pyramid, which leads up to the pinnacle, and that we have become so concerned about the pinnacle that we have lost some of our understanding of the base. But what I'd like to do first is define the terms as I see them, and then because I am a historian, I just simply can't leave it. But I also think it's helpful to understand how we got where we are today, that it cannot be changed overnight, and that the American society and the whole Western world has really been a part of our heritage and a part of what we now have in varsity athletics, in Little League, in all the various forms of sport. Play I see as spontaneous kinds of activities and absolutely essential for all boys and girls, that they must be kids and they must play, and they ought not to be inhibited in the forms of play that they decide upon. And this is certainly one of the places where children can, at least in the afternoon, if you can tolerate it, learn to play. That is, that they are free to run, to fall, to pick themselves up, to determine their own games, and to live in their own worlds. And that's an important part of the growth process. One of the problems we're finding with letting the nursery schools and the preschools have organized kind of play activities is that the children are being structured very young in what it is they will play. And therefore, when you get them, it's important that they have time to just horseplay, as it were, both boys and girls. And that it is terribly important for the bone marrow, for the bone density, for muscles, and for the later use of our bodies, that small children have an opportunity to play. And the sedentary life that we have permitted ourselves to be a part of, and that we permit our children to be a part of, is a serious problem that we all really need to think about because of their later lives. So while we're worrying about their later lives, on the other hand, we're also worrying about their present lives, that they're kids now. And that's what they ought to be when they play, even though it has the value that you people know about. So play is sort of the broadest of terms. And that's what we're really trying to get in physical activity, as opposed to straight exercises. Straight exercises are not fun, as you and I know. And it's a discipline. And that's not the kind of activity the kids need. They need vigorous running, walking, jumping, throwing. And girls particularly need throwing if they are ever going to be able to play to the potential that even girls now are interested in doing. And it's really got to start very young. And you people need to be role models. Even if your attitude is, I don't really like to do this, your behavior needs to be active, because you are the role models, particularly for your girls. What we're finding is that you aren't much in sport as role models for your sons. Your sons will play whether you encourage it or not, because father will. And as we look through the history, we'll know that father will. And it doesn't affect the son if you do not, but it affects your daughter if you do not. If you are not active, or you do not think of activeness, if not really participating in it, then your role model is her role model, even if she plays with her dad's son. We're finding with girls that family encouragement is essential for them to participate in a large number and variety of sports. So you become far more important than had been anticipated in the sports world. We thought the men could take care of it, but the fact is they can't. Now, one of your problems as a role model is, I would venture to say, about half of you don't throw the ball the way your sons and father and husbands throw the ball. But you can imitate that way out rather than this way. You don't have to do the actual throwing very much. You can just imitate. And be sure that the left foot is forward when you throw with your right hand, because that's what they see as they look at you. And that imitation is the very best way for a child under 8 to learn anything, and particularly physical activities, that they learn best by imitation, not by the chatter of the first, second, and third grade physical educator who spends half her time or his time telling them how to do it. They don't need that. They need one focus. And that's all they need as little kids, too. Pick one thing that you're going to teach them and let them do everything else wrong. But whatever is the main thing, that today they're going to step forward with their left foot, then today they step forward with their left foot, even if they're throwing strangely. The important thing on the throw is that the arm comes back and it follows with the ball, and there is a wrist action. And that's all it has to look like, even if you don't send it very far. But it's important we're finding for the role model, because they're watching baseball, girls, and they're still not seeing it, because they are female. And they know from 2 years old on that there's something different. Now, we'd like to get children more what I call androgynous, but they simply aren't. That is, that they have the characteristics of being able to do either. But it's well defined for them already. And so we have to do sort of the work of that. So play is broad. Games start to have some structure. And they're important. It's important to have structure, because the structure then brings the extra learning that can occur through sport. That is a kind of discipline. And you can start that very young. But we're finding the most well-adjusted kids are those that have very few rules in their games. And that we don't want a highly structured game. That America has the most structured games for kids under 6 than any place in the whole world. And you can see how that happens. We want to start relays and contests even before they're in school. And so then we have to have rules. You have to have rules. If winning is the most important thing, you have to have rules. I had a great time last week with the Mini Olympics, in which we just practically had no rules. And it drove the husbands mad. They wanted to know what the rules were. Somebody would walk 3 miles and they were 72. Can we have double count? Sure, that's a good idea, double count. Somebody else thought of, if the elevation changes, ought I get more points? Yeah, you ought to get more points. And any question they asked really came out, yeah, you can do that, since what we wanted was activity in the process. And it drove some of the children. The 9 through 12-year-olds weren't very happy with some of the rules that we didn't have, as opposed to what we had, which is an illustration of what our heads do in relation to the whole sport kind of world. Sport begins to be more organized. Can you play a game of basketball with no skill? Sure, you can try the game of basketball without skill. How long will someone tolerate you in that game if they have a choice? Very short and last picked, which begins to already show us some of the problems that happen. And in the past, the very plump boy, or certainly the girl, is last picked. And when you're last picked, you're not going to get the toy anyway. We've got a lot of studies that are showing and teaching physical education, and I hate to expose my profession, but it's important as you're thinking of moving, that when we clock kids, the poorer the skill level in the sport of the child, the less often that child gets practice in the sport, whether boy or girl. So if we put them into an organized game, a sport, very soon in their experiences, the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. And so you have in the sports world the cans and the can-nots. And when you have a second grade boy who is a can-not, you know the difficulties that can arise. So sport begins to be structured, and we need to limit the exposure of a young child to sport. Then more narrow, at the top of our pinnacle, is athletics. And when I talk about athletics, I'm talking about highly organized competitive sport. And that is the goal for which most boys are told to strive, and now girls are being asked for the same striving. If we had done that with the blacks in relation to being lawyers and doctors, as opposed to basketball players, we would have far more blacks today that would be lawyers and doctors rather than basketball players. So our whole concept, which also shows us what our society can do to a whole group of people, that they could be basketball players because it wasn't as threatening to the Darwin concept of the white male supremacy. And so he could play basketball after once having gotten into the root. And Harry Edwards, one of the black sociologists, talks about in the black world what we have done for making them athletes as opposed to permitting them in other areas. And it comes from that sort of winning syndrome. Exercise, as I see it for kids, is that they do it on their own in a fun setting and not in a formalized setting very often. Until you wish, and they really wish, to train for a particular sport. And the age that that has to happen, according to our experts, is not at 6 years of age. That we can, in fact, make gymnasts out of 12-year-olds. That we can make swimmers out of 12-year-olds. It's a lot harder, but the potential is there, and it gives the child the freedom to be a child. If you decide on a highly competitive sport for a child, remember you are turning them into a miniature adult immediately, if they do not want to do it. Now, if for some reason they are driven for a desire to be in a competitive sport, so be it. Then let's move them into it and let them try the sport, do the sport, while learning some others. One of the problems that we have in our men, my age at least, is that they went through high school, maybe college, and what sports could they play? What sports were your husband's?
Football.
Football.
Yes.
Football, basketball, and
track.
Baseball, yeah. Maybe track. The value of track, however, is at least they can use that as a fundamental to something else. But the trinity of baseball, football, and basketball, the potential for using, particularly football, which is the number one sport, is not very great, except as a spectator. Baseball, you can turn into softball and perhaps do it. Basketball, at least in many, many cities, you can do that, and do that for quite a long time. There's a lot more potential. But if that's all the kid learns is football, you see the difficulty that occurs. So in exercises, unless they're training for something, if you give them the opportunity to have it, they don't need any kind of special exercises to get strength, flexibility, endurance, and the cardiovascular efficiency we talked about yesterday. It will occur if you give them that opportunity. Fitness is the objective of all of this, but it's your objective, not theirs. You keep that in your head. It's not so much in their head. as they are playing. Play and fun ought to be more important than that they are fit. If they do this, they are fit. Your responsibility comes in the nutrition and the food center on the whole fitness. The junk food that we're giving our kids, we're finding, is interfering with them as athletes, even today, that for being a society that can have any food we want, that our athletes in senior high and in college have food deficiencies and nutritional deficiencies from their youth. And most of them coming from upper, low class, or middle class. Even the blacks, particularly who are from inner city, don't have as many nutrition deficiencies as some of the affluent of society. And it's just recently that we're realizing this. So these are the terms. Moving quickly then to how did it all happen. Some of you may have read Tom Brown's School Days. Anybody read Tom Brown's School Days? If you're, you really have to be English rather than Scandinavian for that. But it's written by Tom Hughes, who is an Englishman, and all of our sport traditions, or almost all of them, come from England. Our concept of the gentleman, all of those really move to us from England. Muscular Christianity comes to us as the first push for fitness for Christian reasons. From the 1840s to the 1860s, there's a lot of evangelists in our society that are re-emphasizing the importance of nutrition, of food, of exercises, and they come from England and call our children pansies or pales, mostly pale faces. You can imagine how that goes over with our frontier folks. And out of that comes a fervent desire for fitness, for the body to be a temple of God. And out of that comes muscular Christianity, permitted even then in the Christian environment, that you must have strong bodies. And within that concept creeps in the concept of amateur sportsmanship, character building. Where do we transfer that today? Where are we going to build all these boys' characters? Where can we do it? Says all your physical education teachers. Oh yeah, we're going to build character in sport. You can't answer it because you know it doesn't. The fact is, when you watch sport, you wonder what it is building. But that's the original rationale for sport, was that sportsmanship builds character, character builds cooperation, cooperation builds citizenry, citizenry builds great fathers, great society. So obviously we've got to have muscular Christianity. And muscular Christianity doesn't matter for the female. Muscular Christianity means a male activity and the male body. For the female, she must take care of the Victorian concept of the values. Now you're responsible for all the values, but you don't have to worry about their physiques and their manliness. We'll take care of that in our sports world. Then out of that muscular Christianity came, and I was talking about this yesterday, rite of passage. The rite of passage vis-a-vis sport is the concept of the way to adult malehood is through sport, which gives us a clear picture of why the female is out in left field. Because it's not needed to make a woman. It's essential to make a man. So boy is in second grade and he hates it. How will he ever be a man? Only by reproduction. And because they don't know for sure in the reproduction whether he is or he isn't the father, then the way to manhood becomes sport, because you can see it. And sport becomes far more important than being manly by reproduction. And when you think about that today, it still is. Why do we call someone a sissy? Is that for a female? Can a female be a sissy? In your concepts? Just now. And in fact, someone was telling me we don't use sissy anymore, but we use your woman, that the kid says to the other kid, boys, your woman, as he is unable to compete. So that they've got the new vocabulary, they just switch where it goes. And so we have some difficulties. But the rite of passage is really central to why you're forced to have your little boy in Little League, and why he wants it. that is the road to masculinity. And then it follows that they have to be good in it to be good men. I mean, you can't be unskilled and turn into a great man. Then that follows with what we call the safety valve theory. The safety valve theory says, with the closing of the frontier, we had plenty of chance as rugged individualists to run on out to California, to go to the gold rush, to go to all of our shores. And you can be a man to do that. And so you don't need to play around in sport to prove that you're a man, because you can actually do it. You can be a pioneer. But with the closing of the frontier, the safety valve theory says that when there is no frontier, there is no adventure, there is no risk, that sport became a substitute. And the rise of sport insinuates that that's true. The rise of organized sport in our society comes from 1850 to 1900. It's already in all the colleges. It's really already commercialized by the 20th century on the college level. And so they get all intermingled, and the safety valve theory says we gotta have sport. And so we begin to organize sport in such a way that every child gets an opportunity, boy, child, to participate. And if he doesn't want to, then he's going to have a difficult row to hoe. And even today, we see some of those same problems. So those are all interconnected along with the rugged individualist. He doesn't really have a chance when you look at all of what history tells us of how we're going to make men. Sport becomes terribly central to that, even though it probably hasn't been conscious to you that that's what occurred. Then the rugged individualist is filling up our society, and all the immigrants come, and all the ethnic groups come, and they begin to fight with one another on the streets. What can we do now about that, according to what we now say we have to do in inner cities to keep some sort of good integration, citizenship? What can we use for that? What do we use to try to bridge the gap and have some kind of cooperative spirit? Sports. Central. What does your school say to the school board on why they need money for varsity sport? We've got to have school spirit. Why does it first occur? Because Yale feels inferior to Harvard, because they're an institution made by Harvard, and Harvard is the intellectual institution, so Yale says, and not consciously, but as we sort of interpret the history, Yale says, hey, we'll take athletics. So early on, from the early 70s, athletics begins to mean spirit, status, and all of these kinds of ways. Then, if any of you have heard about the playground movement, the YMCAs, all of the kinds of settlement houses, leagues that form from 1880 to 1920. And those are all formed to help the Scandinavians get together, the Irish get together, and we're going to integrate this into team sports. And so central to then becoming a citizen even is a form of sport. And who succeeds in the whole immigrant group first? Probably the beer brewers first, because they can financially deal. But we begin to pass child labor laws. And when we pass those, then the kids can't go to the factories. The boys can't prove themselves at 11 years of age. And so they've got to find something for the boys to do. And so the playground movement is a substitute then almost for work as well as for play. Who were the great boxers? Any of you know anything about boxing early? Before the blacks? Yeah, the Irish. Who was the lowest immigrant in terms of where they came from? The Irish, the potato farmers. And so they became the outcasts. And outcasts are always in boxing. And so the Irish have great boxers as they pull themselves up. So sport is a way from very early for up the ladder for the minority groups. And it makes men out of them, and it makes citizens. So the whole concept of citizenry, you move then into nationalism, and you're practically not nationalistic if you're all not listening to those Olympics. It is obviously that you don't have a national spirit. So we begin to put those together. And so what can a boy do? If he wants to be patriotic, he can join the military or he can play in sport. That gives him that feeling, but then he has to spend all this time in skill area. So basically what we have is a forced entry into the sports world. And as soon as you're forced into something and everybody says it's the thing to do, then you begin to have the rebellion, and pretty soon sport doesn't have all its positive kinds of qualities about it. And it begins to be the center of stress and tension rather than the relaxation that can occur. And putting all of that together historically with our very favorite win syndrome, and that to play is to win, puts us into the position that we have miniature adults in our little boys, and all of the problems then that occur with the miniature adults. And so the win syndrome, as I see it, never died. The varsity sport that occurs gives us difficulty. Trying to move from rugged individualism to collective behavior also comes through Theodore Roosevelt. From your historical past, give me the characteristics of Theodore Roosevelt. What was he like?
Outdoor.
Adventurous. He's going to drive in and take us to war. Vocal about everything. His concept that he leaves with us is his vigor, his physical ability. Actually, he has a very difficult time physically. He has asthma. And as a child, was a very puny child. And it may speak to his later efforts to be sure that our men are men. And he talks in the end of the 19th century about the women are taking over this world. My wife runs me. The men are effeminate. So in the college world, what can we do to prevent that? Well, obviously we can play football, because football is the sport of sports. And one year, over 23 people, young men, were killed in playing football before they had the helmets and before they had the forward pass, which meant all 22 men came together. And so Theodore Roosevelt realizes that Yale and Harvard are about to drop football. University of Chicago has already dropped football. Stanford has not permitted football in. So the big universities of the end of the century get together to discuss that. So they drop football, and everybody lives happily ever after. Hardly at all. Theodore Roosevelt has a hidden agenda, as all presidents do. Some don't hide them as much. But his agenda is, we're going to play football, but we'll figure out how to play it so there are not as many injuries. As the result, they move to the forward pass, which opens up the position. They move to a line, they move to four downs within about a 10-year period. And so football is saved for democracy, certainly. It is saved for eternity so that we don't have to fight wars. We're going to have it as a substitute for war. And so you just never realize how important football really was to the success of our society. But in fact, it really is the symbol of manliness. Now you can throw in wrestling and boxing and some of those. But you can see that it really determined the role that sport was going to play in our society. And having looked at that, and you move down then to our results, as you see it today from your observation, and yours observations may not be as frequent as your husband's are, but you must see some of the problems that have arisen out of that. What are some of the problems that have occurred from the results of our historical heritage? What do we have? Any negatives? These are all pretty positive.
Too much emphasis on sports, and sometimes that doesn't carry over to a job.
Okay, one of the problems is the emphasis on sport, and so that the child is interested only in sport. And some way or other, even our teachers permit that to be a good substitute. Well, we will substitute that they can play sports. We have some national heroes today. Who are national heroes because they have participated in sport. We've got a whole generation of professional basketball players, for example, And the taxpayers and you and I have spent a lot of money on those young men, and less than 50% of them are college graduates. And another whole raft have only 1 year of college, which means they were exploited, used, and then sent out to the pastures. Now, if they succeed, which is something like one in a million, particularly the black boys, if they succeed, then the story gets carried on, and it's okay if you don't know the academic world. And so our emphasis has just been so huge that we've made it central. Now, of course, they're not the only ones. We've made it central in our lives. In The Joy of Sport, which is kind of an interesting book on what happens in the sports world, and it talks about the difficulties of it. But certainly, making sport central, then making sport and competition central, what happens to the fat little second grade boy or the very frail first grade girl? What happens to their psychics?
They're stigmatized so early and never able to recover from it.
There is no recovery for the third grade boy unless he finds something or somebody helps him find something that he sees as not sport, even if it's physical activity. Jogging is a good example. A lot of men have been saved for fitness and their lives saved in a sense, and women too, actually, by finding either jogging or walking or a sport that does not demand throwing, running, and jumping skills, which are the fundamental skills. But all of our studies are showing with those second graders that already the boy and even the girl knows how to hide. That within a gymnasium, within a playground, we've taught them how to hide, that they really don't have to practice. And by moving from play into sport too quickly, it's easy to see them. You see them not able to succeed. And in particularly the book on Every Kid Can Win, it's written by a man from British Columbia and the Vancouver School District, in which they made an effort to take ice hockey, which every kid knows how to skate in Vancouver, evidently. And so they took the sport of ice hockey and changed it. So for the 9 through 12 year old group, they never played on the same team the entire hour that they might be there. That they had teams, but it was blue, green, black, orange, purple. And you played 5 minutes, and then you went off to a young man that would teach some of the skills that you were supposed to just have. Then there's another person coaching here, and they go out and coach sort of as the kids are playing. But the score really is made, and all the rules are followed, but you don't have a winner and loser. And the interesting thing about that experiment was the first year that they put it in, wrote and told the parents, 50% of the kids didn't join it. So it was down 50%. The next year it was up to 90% of what it had been, and the third year it had an increase up to about 125%, which seems to illustrate that parents, teachers, the kids themselves like it. And it really makes you think, maybe, just maybe, our kids really don't need or want that highly competitive spirit, that they are fun-loving, frolicking sorts of kids, and that we can help them to want that. It's interesting to talk to your kids, if you have any from 9 to 12 here, on how they like this place and how they like what's happening. And you will have opposite extremes, which...
I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old, and we're having no problem.
Yeah, well, because their whole... They're excluded in terms of the life of the village, and what they're used to, some of them, and I don't know if it's so much your children, is organized play, where they are structured into a sport. And so what we really have tried to do with the next group, and not quite so much this group, is to have the family sort of walking, hiking. And that's one of the purposes in asking for families, is trying to get them to have activity together. But it's really difficult when that's not the home structure. It's not our societal structure. You have to work twice as hard to make it within the structure, because we're purposefully not having as much age group, and certainly not after noon, that the activity has to be really parental in terms of what it is they are going to do. And that's pretty tough when that's not the structure at home. But what it begins to do, if you can find something that you all like to do and can do, it's a new experience, even if it's only one day, as they're not sort of generally happy. If they get one day of a hike that everybody is doing within the family structure or friend or organized or somewhere, it's that exposure that is new and different. I find a lot of young men that don't like it either, that their own being is far more structured in the sports that they will do. You will notice that conspicuously we don't have a tennis court here. And that was a purposeful action to not have organized sport with the exception of a very poor volleyball court. And that was much more for the staff that was here continuously and for what the thought was would be four volleyball courts there. So you could ability group yourself and then all the children could play because it would be by their ability group. And that's also, of course, what needs to happen, as I see it, in physical education and everywhere, that we ability group and not age group, actually, so that you have, and someone is always helping those that are not in the top group, as opposed to that someone's always helping the top group and not the bottom. I would terribly resent, if I were a parent, all of the attention and all of the help given to that 3% of the varsity athletes. Because everybody else loses in favor of the varsity. And as we worked on the women's programs with our great idealism and our lack of understanding of power, we thought that we could have intramurals on a large base and then move up with 10% of the females at least in varsity sport. And of course, what we found is that our society had already been structured on what happened. And so as I see it, it's going to have to be the parents and the school board members that decide how it is we're going to expose kids to a larger array of activities. And those that live in larger towns, you have more chance because you have an opportunity to really spread sort of the activities out. What are some of the other problems? And then we'll go to the positives, because I think there's a lot of value in sport, and of course that's why I'm in it, because I think that it can be all positive, and that we sort of force it into the negative by our historical past, and that we can sort of move it out of there into the new games and into new kinds of activities. But what are some of the other problems that occur in the highly competitive world? One of the problems is physical injury in terms of lack of preparation. That kids ought not to have to prepare for play. And so what happens is coaches are vigorously trying to force training upon kids, even the 9 through 12. And so physical injury occurs because their bones are not ready. And if I were a parent, I would never let my son or daughter be a pitcher who is under the age of 12 or 13 for any long stretch of time. We have bad elbows from boys who were in Little League in the 60s. We can demonstrate it on up that their elbows have been injured for life. The other injury for life, by the way, happens to be the javelin. And we don't have a lot of little kids throwing the javelin. But some of our football injuries on junior high also is that the bones were not built for having knocking bone on bone. And so in a normal situation, kids will play tackle football and some will get hurt. But hardly ever do they get injured for life from playing sandlot anything. That sandlot ball, when they get tired, for one thing, when they fatigue, and kids will fatigue, particularly your kids from 9 through 12 that are sort of beginning to grow, they actually fatigue. But they will never fatigue in front of a coach, and particularly a coach that is a forceful coach living his own ego, or her own ego, by the way, in the new world, and pushing. That no matter how you look at it, generally there's pushing that's going on in these highly competitive. Normally, the kid would say, let's quit and go climb a tree or go do something else. And so lost in our society, for one thing, really is Sandlot. And along then with the Sandlot is the cooperative spirit and the give and take. Who makes, whether it's an out or not an out, on the Sandlot decision? The kid or the kid that owns the toy, but everybody works it out. Even if it's the bully, it's really no different than the official making it where you can't even argue it. Or what you do is cheat as far as you can because you don't have any responsibility for that. One of the things that we have taught kids is how to cheat. We show it on TV all the time. We'll pull the face mask. And it's go just as far as you can. Trip them down the floor in basketball and show it on the television. So that kids are taught how to cheat. And put on top of that, that the coach thinks it's okay. And you can see how we end up in the world. Now, kids will cheat in the Sandlot, too. But peers are able to take care of one another. And we're really not letting that happen. We're not really letting kids have to make decisions. That's one of the whole values, as I see it, of sport, is that kids do learn to play together by playing together. Not so much by a coach saying you must play together, although that can help. The fact is, the kid learns that together, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that's an important kind of cooperative thing to learn. It's certainly important in marriage to learn. That what you can do separately, that the whole brings out a much greater enhancement. And when they once learn it in sport, and I think a perfect example of that, whether you like the team and some of their antics or not, is that Georgetown basketball team that won the national championship. They had a team effort in which they knew, except for Ewing, as individual players, they were not as good as the players around the country. But somehow the coach was able to instill in them the importance of the togetherness that occurs and the importance of our respect for one another. The best value example that I think I've ever seen and heard of is on the game in which Georgetown lost in the finals from a gentleman named Brown who threw the ball away. And the coach went up afterwards and put his arm around the man and evidently talked to try to alleviate the stress and the problems that were occurring. And that's when I see the positives of sport, and I wouldn't throw it away for anything. I think it has an important role to play. But in that playing, that the winning seems to be what is causing, even the injuries, that the injuries are coming late in the fourth quarter. The kid would have just stopped playing normally. A lot of the deaths that we are seeing occur. And if you read the newspaper, you'll find more and more deaths occurring among high school kids. It's scary. And part of that is nutrition. And part of that is the continuous pressure that a kid never would have had on the farm doing the same amount of physical activity. In a book that I think Norma's going to talk about, Stress of Life by Selye, he talks about what continuous stress does. And that's what some of the sports is. When you ask your kids about whether he missed the ball or he didn't, particularly baseball, it really shows up. And the stress that they have, they can't sleep the night before a game. A 10-year-old kid that can't sleep the night before a big game is simply too big a game in the sense of what we are doing. And had they been free to play that same game block against block out there in the Sandlot without you all there, you have a great deal more freedom. What I'd really like in competitive sports on maybe up to 14 is you can't have any spectators there. That you just play the game. I have seen some horrendous action by mothers who really don't even know the game, which makes it even worse to me. A mother saying, how come my kid's not playing? And the mother doesn't know. Or they hear the father comes once. He comes once all season, takes off work, and so watches this game, and wouldn't you know, his kid misses the ball in center field. You'd think the whole world had come to an end. And so what I'm really saying is it's the adult world that don't let kids play in sport. And yet that I like some of the discipline that does occur in sport, and that we do make kids better, I think, by the sport experience. Or we can. We may not. But that's one of its potential. What's some of the other problems or values that you see in the either competitive scene or even if you've seen some recreational scenes that look pretty good?
What? There's a value in learning to lose.
There's a value in learning to lose. And our society, remember, is a competitive society. Your kids learn in grades one that there's something about an A that's better than a D. And it doesn't matter how much work has been put into that. And I think Norma's going to talk about that perhaps tomorrow. And the whole concept of competition in the academic world, you can just put it over into the sports world and double it. Because you see the winners and the losers. In reading, you may not know who can and who can't. But it is immediately apparent in the sports world. And that's one of the scary things about being in that field, is seeing the winning and the losing. What are some of the ways that you use for helping a kid who thinks in win and loss terms and they do lose? What's some of the major things to think about in that losing and making it a positive kind of value? Or is it never?
Regardless of what they've done something well. Or they have at least, if they've done it their best, they have nothing to be feeling bad about. So if you can teach them to always do their best, even if they lose, they can be proud or pleased with themselves for the effort that they put forward.
Well, I know in my classroom, I always try and stress the idea that we're all good in some things, and none of us are good in everything, you know. I mean, there have to be winners and losers all along. And, you know, at the end of the year when we give awards, I mean, everybody gets an award for something that he's good at, you know, I mean, if it's reading or music or sports or whatever.
Any other?
I'm always impressed with the concept of when someone's playing a game, that following either the rules or how to do it becomes more important than when you win. Like, I've been with you sometime when you've been bullying and you're watching some kid bull, or you do worse than I do, and you feel good about it. And yet I've done better than you, but it's because you knew that that's the way you're supposed to throw a ball. Now that's the way you're supposed to do it, so that's okay that it didn't go down. And then it blows my mind, but...
blows my mind when she wins, really. But it is the importance of them realizing that people are better than they are in anything. But what you get from it is the learning that occurs, and that you have really learned something. I have a very tough time because I'm very competitive, and as a woman in a competitive world, it's probably been a lot harder, and so I'm even more competitive. And I find it come out in very unusual ways. My nephew was in a tennis tournament, and I was so thrilled that he bothered to play tennis instead of Little League. He already had bad knees and his elbow hurt. In some way, he got in a tennis tournament. And what do you think I said when he came home from his first match?
Did you win?
And David doesn't mix punch. He said, Annie Jo, I thought it didn't matter whether I won or not. Oh, yes. Well, that's true. And so it's not going to happen automatically. B?
I said the raw form comes up.
That's true. It comes out in the volleyball court, too, if you've ever been there. In terms of the competitive sort of spirit. But on the other hand, someplace I've learned, and I don't know how, and that's why everybody has to find their own way of learning how, that I don't mind losing at all if the people are good. And that, in fact, often I feel honored in tennis playing if I play with a good player and in a good group where we have had lots of rallies and people win points. People don't lose points. And I think some way, if we can get across that, not that I have beat somebody, but that I have won something, or that somebody else won something. In some way, if you can shift the emphasis while still learning. And it's really difficult to do that.
Children always understand that, though. You know, I mean, that I'm happy to lose to that guy because he's really good. You know, I don't think small children understand
that. And that comes out of that we're still on that winning kind of syndrome. If you've left that kid alone.
You're still so self-centered,
both self-centered, but they've also got societies or our culture that has said to them that you have to win. You know, kids aren't born having to win. They definitely have learned someplace. And if you look at a room full of you people, for example, if you were not in highly structured sport, your concept of competition must differ from your husband's or men. And that comes out of how you were raised. And it's not innate. You are not innately not competitive. Because if two of you want the same husband, you see about competition. So it's not innate that you're not competitive. But it's in the learning process you have learned that winning isn't as important as something else. Clean house, able to cook, take care of children, all of the helping skills. Helping skills are not competitive skills. They're cooperative skills. And so once you get girls into a competitive situation and teach them, they really are more cooperative in a team. I had wonderful volleyball teams at Concordia because they had already learned cooperation. All I had to teach them was a little aggression. And some of them already had sort of the feeling of it, but they knew how to cooperate. Boys have a more difficult time learning that, and everybody starts with that same self-centeredness. But our culture projects to that child that he's less because he hasn't won. And it's someplace in areas like this that we can make them understand that your self-esteem is not based on win or loss, but whether you really have put forth the effort and if it is, in fact, what you want to do. And I think that's what becomes important also with girls. I haven't really talked about girls because girls did not have, historically, the difficulty. They didn't have the competitive difficulty. What was the problem that girls, including you people, experienced as children in the play world?
Tomboy.
Yeah, that if you did compete, that you were a tomboy, and it was okay until 12, maybe 13. A neighbor across the street from where I lived told another neighbor, Mrs. Story, that I, at 13, I was still playing tag football in the street. And I really wasn't bad, particularly at catching it. But she told Mrs. Story that I really ought to quit playing football in the street with the boys now. That I really was too grown up for that. And that is a terrible moment for your 12 and 13 year olds. When they begin to change and want to have much more feminine concepts, but they still have all that skill and all that ability. And I think today we're dealing with that wonderfully, and that the sport world is far more equal. But that's also where I have a lot more trouble, because now we're all imitating the male model, and I had hoped someplace in my dreams that we could combine the best of both worlds, and we simply aren't going to be able to. The power structure says that I can't do that for all girls, that it's going to have to be all parents and all peoples working together to try to keep the pinnacle while still trying to deal with the baseline and the grassroots. And I'm not sure exactly how we do this, but that's sort of the essential point. And for girls, I think the other essential point is the whole concept of ability grouping. That you group according to the ability level. And so you will have more girls over the long haul that are in the lower part of the learning. But if you give them more toys to play with, more balls to have, more bats, more soccer balls, they need more than the boys need in the advanced group. Because the advanced group will share that one toy and have a whee of a time if you let them. But the instruments and equipment are needed for the lower realm of both boys and girls because they simply aren't using the toy. Within the sports world, I think, as you look at the kinds of sports that you want your children to grow up with, what do you think gives the most opportunity for exercise, fitness, and not as much stress within the team sport world. Yeah, soccer. Soccer is the most exciting new sport for kids because the only one that's really under pressure is the goalie. And even the goalie is usually protected by the coach. It's interesting to me that a coach will protect a goalie, and that's okay, and praise. And remember, praise and reinforcement is the way you need to deal with both yourselves and kids in starting any new sport. Think of the frustration of learning to do something left-handed if you're right-handed, or if any of you started tennis, or golf, or racquetball, or any of these sports, how frustrating it is if you don't get reinforcement. And so one of the important things is that reinforcement. And soccer is one of the best examples because everybody's starting from scratch in soccer in the last 10 years. And only the goalie is being watched carefully. The kid knows if he's made a good play and if he's dodged or she's dodged. It's also a sport that at least until 12 or 13, it can be played as co-ed because the boys haven't learned it any more than the girls. It's one of the best examples to me of co-education, of how it can work once you've broken the gap that occurs. But you should remember that there is still a gap. We've been testing young girls from 5 to 8 years of age, and they simply throw about 42%, the boys throw 42% farther than the girls on the average. And it has nothing to do with muscles, and it has nothing to do musculature, that is, and nothing to do with the leverages. What it does have to do is experience and the muscle mass that they have developed by having played. While on running, that there isn't about a 20% difference in the running difference and very little in balance. So it is in the throwing skills. And the problem with the throwing skills is once the girl is fully matured, she will have an even greater difference in the arm and shoulder girdle because of the pectoralis major and minor muscles. So she really needs to be able to learn to throw earlier. So anyway, there is this large gap right now. But in the ability grouping, it takes care of those gaps. And it becomes important, I think, and my final plea is the importance of teaching play activities, sports and games, and even athletics for your girl. Because what we're finding in women now is the deficiencies that occurred because they did not actively participate in activity. And so it becomes important that you encourage and re-encourage and enforce and reinforce for the girls that they compete or that they play, that they have games in sport. And finally, for your boys then, it seems to me that if we can de-emphasize athletics without de-emphasizing sport and emphasizing instead the importance of the joy of movement and dealing with the praise and the excitement and the adventure of all kinds of physical activity, that then we will have a future generation that can play, can sport, can be in athletics, can live their lives, and I think live it more fully. Good. All.